Welcome to Meet the Press Slam, episode 6 of this run. Here, I've been on a consistent run this time. We've had four or five great guests here, starting with Kevin, Aaron Rock, Josh, and Gerard, of course, Gerard DiTrolio of Voices of Wrestling, and we have another Voices of Wrestling contributor and a Wrestling Inc. contributor as well. I recently did an article for Voices of Wrestling highlighting mental health and my journey with wrestling through mental health. My mental health journey through wrestling, through the eyes of wrestling. And this guy is a great contributor for Voices of Wrestling and Wrestling Inc. He is Jesse Collings. Jesse Collings, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Danny. This is I'm up in Boston, and this is our first very hot day of the year. Like, I think it's like 88 degrees outside right now, and so I haven't put my air conditioners in my apartment yet. So today is like going to be probably the hottest day of the year for me, at least inside.
Yikes!
But other than that, I'm doing fantastic.
Yikes, indeed. We all know what in the Northeast, like. I'm in Philadelphia, just to be aware. And, like, if you have, like, an AC unit and you haven't put it in yet, when it gets hot, it's like, oh, too little, too late.
Yeah, well, it was one of those things where it's like, it felt like this time last week, it was, like, 50 degrees outside.
Yeah.
So I was, like, you know, going outside wearing a jacket. And then all of a sudden, like, earlier this week, we got a report. It was like, oh, and by the way, it's going to be, like, 85 Friday and Saturday. And I was like, damn, like, there was no, like,
warning.
Springtime at all. It just went from kind of like winter time to now it's now going to be like hot with like a humidity of 100%, you know, until October.
Yes, yes. And Jesse is a great contributor for Wrestling Inc. and Wizard Wrestling, and he hosts the Gentleman's Wrestling podcast as well, which is a great listen. So, how did you become a wrestling fan? You're actually the same age as me, almost. I'm 26, you're 27. So, I'm interested in, like, how you came along as a wrestling fan, because it might be similar to my path.
Yeah, I would say it's pretty typical. I don't have, like, a crazy story. As, like, a really little kid, like, when I was, like, you know, 7 or 8 years old, I didn't watch wrestling. I didn't watch wrestling as a at that age. I was vaguely aware of it. Like, one of my neighbors had a WWF game for the N64 that we used to play. So I knew, like, who, like, The Undertaker was, and I knew who Triple H and The Rock obviously were, but I never really watched it. It wasn't until I was in fifth grade, which would have been, like, I would say 2005 would be when I first started watching wrestling, like, regularly. And that was just because, you know, some of the other boys at school started, you know, talking about it. I'm like, oh, wrestling. And I kind of had a small interest in it because I liked playing the video game. And so I just started watching SmackDown, Danny. Like,
yes.
Because Raw was on, you know, from a 9 to 11 p.m. East Coast time on Monday nights, which my parents were not, like, I didn't stay up till 11 o'clock at night when I was that age on a school
night.
Neither
were my parents.
Yeah, no, so certainly not. So I never really, but SmackDown was on from 8 to 10 on Thursday nights. And then kind of shortly after that, they moved to Friday nights when they moved to CW. When I first started watching, they were still on UPN. And so, like, SmackDown was really attainable as a kid to watch. So I watched it pretty regularly, you know, like, you know, I got super into it. I got DVDs. I started getting the video games. I was, you know, watching SmackDown every week. But after about, you know, like two or 3 years, I would say, like, I watched a lot from like 2005 to 2007. I eventually just kind of stopped watching it. I think the way a lot of kids did, and, you know, everyone at school stopped watching it. We just kind of one of those things where it's a phase and then you kind of grow out of it. Like,
right.
There was a whole phase where I was really into Yu-Gi-Oh, you know, like when I was like in like third or fourth grade. And then eventually when I got to middle school, like, I didn't do Yu-Gi-Oh anymore. And so wrestling to me was kind of similar to that. But then when I got to high school, I just, one day, me and my friend were just like, let's watch wrestling. Like, we were around or something on a Monday night or something like that. It's like, dude, let's just, like, watch wrestling. Just see, like, how different it is. Because there was kind of a curiosity I had, because I had no idea what was going on. I didn't know who, like, you know, who had been champion or anything like that. So I started, so we just tuned back in, like, no, I would say this was, like, 2009, 2010. And I just started, I got right back into it, and I just started watching Raw every week. And that's when I would consider I, like, really got into wrestling, and I've been watching consistently ever since.
I never had that lull period.
Yeah, it was kind of weird. Like, it was like, I got into it as a little kid, like, really into it, and then I just kind of fell out of it. And then, you know, for whatever reason, my interest was peaked. Know in high school to tune in one time. It wasn't like I heard that something awesome was happening, or it wasn't like I heard like someone was making a big return. It was just like a random episode of Raw, and I can't even remember that much what happened. It was like I remember seeing like Mark Henry was a babyface, and he had been a heel when I was watching earlier, and I was like, oh, that's cool. Like, I like Mark Henry. I'm glad he's a babyface now. It was right during a period where John Cena and Randy Orton were having like their feud where they like, you know, traded the title back and forth.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And just they were just about starting to integrate like the gimmick pay per views. Like they had the Breaking Point pay per view, and then they had the Hell in a Cell pay per view. Like kind of like the introduction of those concepts as pay per views were kind of right when I started to get back into it.
Yeah, the Breaking Point pay-per-view was the I Quit match between Randy Orton and John Cena, where John Cena used the tape.
If you was remember. I don't think he used the tape against Batista in a Last Man Standing.
Oh, yeah! I get those two confused, because...
Yeah, it was around the same time period, but yeah, I think the Breaking Point one, he used, like, handcuffs and he put him in the STF.
Oh, yeah.
He might have used tape too. It kind of sounds vaguely familiar that he might have used tape twice. There was this period of time where John Cena was like finding wacky solutions to like win matches. Like there was one where he like took apart the ring to like, I think he was like handcuffed to a ring post, and he like used like a screwdriver that he found to take it apart. Like it was these kind of weird mix that they were using, like where he would like MacGyver his way into wrestling wins.
It was like ingenuity at its finest.
Yeah, it was like this weird phase, but yeah, like that. I think like the Breaking Point, like the match, like that. What I would say, like I remember that being like a big angle was like the whole I Quit match that they were having, and it was like they DX came back, like they reformed again to feud with like Legacy, and they came out in the tank. That was like another thing that I remember kind of happening. And whatever, you know, it's when I look back at all that stuff, I kind of think it was bad, but it did work in the sense that I was watching every week again. After kind of having been lapsed for a few years.
Yeah, I was about to lapse at the time CM Punk happened. And then CM Punk happened. And then I never looked back.
You mean like the... What do you mean?
Pipe bomb CM Punk.
Yeah, so like the pipe bomb promo and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was like... I was like in like 10th grade in high school. And then I was about to laugh because I was like, more important things are happening. Like, I was getting depressed, you know, stuff like that. But then CM Punk happened, and I was like, whoa. This sort of changes my view on wrestling as a whole.
Yeah, you're right. I was definitely really into it by that point. It's hard for me to remember. I don't think I was into getting out of it. But it was definitely like, a real like, transformative moment in that, like, holy shit, like, well, he just said, what? Like, I was worked, like, I was like, he went off script, like, I can't believe he said that. Like, I totally thought it was, like, a total shoot. Like, I didn't think it was, like, a work shoot or anything like that. It definitely was, like, you know, it's one of the most important moments in wrestling history, really. And certainly over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. And I think everyone that's, like, our age, that's still a wrestling fan now, is going to relate to that moment in a way that, like, people that are a generation older might relate to, like, the formation of the NWO.
Or Austin 316.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think a lot of people remember, like, Austin 316. Like, it's like Steve Austin himself is a big figure, but I don't think, like, a lot of people weren't watching when he said the Austin 316.
Oh, like, I see what you mean.
Yeah, like, I'm talking about, like, people, like, who are just older will be like, I remember what happened when, you know, Hulk Hogan formed the NWO, and people who are older than that will point to the Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, twin referee thing on Saturday Night's Main Event as, like, that kind of thing. But every generation kind of has this moment where, like, the wrestling fandom either peaks or just becomes, like, this huge, you know, thing that they'll always remember, like, what they were doing when that moment happened.
Yeah.
It's funny, like, I used to go on Wrestling Inc. as a user first, obviously, and when the CM Punk, so, like, what would generally happen was I would watch Raw, and then I would, the next day, I had, like, basically, like, a free period in school.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you kind of just chill in a computer lab, which I know schools don't have computer labs anymore, but, and I would go on wrestling, and I would kind of write, like, these mini recaps just in, like, a comment section where I would do, like, these pros and cons over the last night's episode of Raw. And I'd watch Raw the night before, and I would, like, I kind of think about, like, you know, overnight or, like, in the morning, like, what I was going to say, like, what I was going to actually write in my little, like, pros and cons thing. But when the CM Punk pipe bomb happened, like, I sprinted upstairs to my computer, like, turned it on at, like, you know, 11 o'clock on a school night, and I had to be online. I had to talk about it with other people. There's no grace period. I couldn't wait, you know, I couldn't sleep and then wait, you know, for my free period at school to kind of, like, formulate my thoughts. I had to talk about it right now. And that definitely, you know, it's funny, I never really thought about it like that, but, like, that definitely is, like, a transformative period of time for me as a wrestling fan. To really get into it in that kind of way.
I think another transformative period for wrestling fans was that period before Wrestle Kingdom 9. And that rise of New Japan, like, we see it coming. We see it coming. But people are slowly becoming more aware. And I first saw the Ishii Shibata match, I believe, in, like, November of 2013. And, boy, did that change my perception of what wrestling can be.
Uh-huh.
That Ishii Shibata match. And then I fell in love with New Japan slowly thereafter. And I can't believe my dad let me order Wrestle Kingdom 9 from Global Force. My God.
Yeah.
You know, I pirated it to stay up. I stayed up. And pirated it the morning of, and then watched it on pay-per-view the day of, because I had to know.
Yeah, with New Japan. So, as I got more into wrestling fandom and I was online and I was reading kind of things, I became really fascinated with Dave Meltzer's star ratings.
Yes, me too.
I was on like IWDB, like the Internet Wrestling Database site.
Oh yeah, that IWDB. Yeah.
ProFightDB.com. It was before I realized that Cage Match was a thing.
Yeah. I didn't know Cage Match was a thing either. So I would go on ProFightDB.com during, like, lunch periods and grab and look at Dave Meltzer's star ratings and see who the heck is this Shibata guy? Who the heck is Misawa? Who the heck is Kobashi? Yeah. Oh, wait.
So I became kind of obsessed with them. Like, anytime I'd watch a wrestling match, or especially if it's an older match, I'd want to go on and see what Dave rated it. Like, could be something from, you know, the 90s or the 80s that I had on DVD or something like that. And so I kind of became obsessed with it. And obviously, like, I became really interested in, like, five-star matches and what matches got five stars from Dave. And there was... Oh, you know, people who are more recent to Dave who probably might find this hard to believe, given how liberally he gives them out now. But there was, like, a really long gap in time where Dave did not give out any five-star ratings. And it was right around the time period period that you and I are talking, like 2009,
yeah.
2010. Yeah. Where he hadn't given one, I think, in like 5 years. Maybe he did, and I'm misremembering. Maybe there was one, but he obviously, you know, he didn't give one in WWE for a really long time. Like, I think he went longer. He went like 10 years.
97. It was the Hell in a Cell.
Yeah, he gave one to the Shawn Michaels Undertaker first Hell in a Cell match. And I think he didn't give one again until the CM Punk John Cena match at Money in the Bank in like 2011. So like I was really curious to know. So, and then one day I don't, you know, I had to bed Ben, you know, shortly after this show, he gave a 5-star match out. It was to Hiroshi Tanahashi and Minoru Suzuki from Kings of Pro Wrestling. It had to have been 2010 or 2011. And I didn't really know, I knew nothing about, I knew what New Japan Pro Wrestling was, but I don't think I'd ever seen probably hadn't seen a New Japan match before in my life. I knew it from, like, you know, going through the database and seeing, oh, you know, New Japan Pro Wrestling, it's like the big company in Japan. When he gave that one, and I was like, oh my God, he gave a 5-star match out, like.
It was 2012.
Yeah, 2012, okay, that's about right. I was in high school at the time. I would have been a senior in high school. And he, so I had to see that match. Like, I had never really watched that much New Japan before. I started getting into independent wrestling, which kind of led me into some Puro. But that was the match that I had to see, was the Tanahashi Suzuki match, because Dave gave it 5 stars. And then
it was the same thing with Ishii Shibata for me. I was like, Dave gave this 5 stars, so I have to see it. And
yeah, I found it on YouTube or Daily Motion or something like that. And so that kind of led me to this whole world of New Japan, and I started. I remember watching the match, and I don't really remember like thinking the match was like that amazing. Because it's kind of hard when you're watching. Like, I never watched really that much Japanese pro wrestling, so I was kind of thrown out. I didn't really understand the beats of the match. I didn't understand that much of the story between Suzuki and Tanahashi. You know, there was no English commentary back then, so I was just kind of watching these two guys I'd never seen before. So I don't really remember being like that into the match itself, but it obviously was enough for me to continue to pay attention to New Japan. And you know, that's when Okada started really taking off. So then I became really enamored with Okada. And then it all snowballed from there, right? You know, AJ Styles, who was this wrestler I really liked in TNA, he ends up in New Japan, which really helped my interest, because now it's like, oh, now I know a guy who's in New Japan who I'm familiar with. And he wins the title, you know, I think in his first or second match.
Yeah, Invasion Attack 2015, I believe it was, or 2014.
Yeah, and that would have been, that was the first New Japan show I ever purchased on pay-per-view. I bought it on Ustream.
Oh yeah, the Ustream days. Oh,
yeah, before you had
New Japan World.
Before New Japan World, I bought it on Ustream, and I watched it in the middle of the night at college. Like, I watched the AJ Styles Okada match, and I watched the whole pay-per-view, and I was like, I remember at the time, like, I was watching it on Ustream. I wasn't really on like wrestling message boards, and I wasn't on Twitter or anything like that. I really didn't know. I wasn't even an Observer subscriber at that time. I really didn't know anyone that, you know, watched Japanese pro wrestling. It was really like kind of strange to look back. Like, I had no one else. I had no one to talk about it with. Like,
that was me too.
Like, it kind of felt like I was alone watching it. Like, I knew there was probably other fans, but it was very obscure. When I was watching the pay-per-view on the Ustream, there were other people watching it, and Ustream had like a chat feature similar to kind of like how YouTube has a chat feature for its live streams. And I was talking about New Japan and Japanese pro wrestling with God knows who, like these other strangers that were up in the middle of the night watching the pay-per-view on Ustream. And so that kind of helped take my wrestling fandom to like another level, where I started exploring outside of American pro wrestling and getting really into Japanese pro wrestling and puro and that kind of thing.
Mine is a little different because I became enamored with New Japan right away, and I found Voices of Wrestling because I was like, I'm looking for a podcast that covers this. I'm looking for a podcast that, because I used to listen to a podcast called Wrestling Soup at the time, and I was like, I would call in and talk about New Japan and get left out of the building because they were a WWE exclusive podcast, and I was very hyped about this New Japan thing, and I needed another outlet to talk about it, so I found in 2014, 2015, Joe and Rich. And then I started doing my own show at Monco in college around that time. And it's funny how things happen for a reason, because I would do this show called The Chat Down, which this guy wanted to do like WWE only, and I was like, no, there's this movement in Japan that's happening, and you better watch out, because this movement's going to take over wrestling, and boy, was I right. And it did, and I was like, I was influenced by Meltzer, I was influenced by that, so I got Semper Vivi on. For the first few of my shows, I lost these recordings, I swear. And it was so weird. It was so weird how this community became so supportive of it.
Yeah, I mean, I was, it's one of the, like, it's funny you mentioned, like, WWE only and, like, calling into Wrestling Soup and they'd laugh at you. We talk about this a lot, like, for such a long time, you were able to subside. You could be, like, a major wrestling media figure. You could have a successful podcast or a successful website, right, or blog. You really only ever talk about WWE.
That ain't the case anymore.
You could talk, you know, sometimes you had to talk about TNA, and you could always kind of get away with TNA being a joke, because TNA always did things to make itself a joke. You know, even though if there was a lot of good stuff that happened in between those things. But you really, you could be a major podcast, you know, you could be a major thing and really only ever know WWE. And what AEW has done is kind of expose a lot of those people who maybe previously we thought of, or viewers thought of, as like, oh, they're wrestling experts. And they really just know WWE. And a lot of AEW coming along, which is something so mainstream that you cannot ignore it. If you're a major podcast, you can't be that. You cannot have a shred of seriousness and just totally ignore AEW. And it exposes a lot of those people for, you know, the you know, when people are confused about things that AEW does that are things that WWE wouldn't do. And they have, we joke about WWE brainworms and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it really did. There are people who dismissed New Japan Pro Wrestling, they dismissed TNA, they dismissed independent wrestling and the strides that Ring of Honor had made, you know, throughout the 2010s. And then all of a sudden AEW happened, and they're, you know, so many people are woefully unprepared to analyze it, because all they ever knew for 20 years was WWE. Or maybe they knew WCW, which honestly, like, isn't that much better. It's wrestling from 30 years ago that, you know, followed a lot of the same rules that WWE did. And it's not necessarily like a more modern hip product the way AEW is.
And I would think, I felt like I was one of those fans who was ahead of the curve. And like, people were groan at me. People would say, Danny, it's not going to happen. Danny, it's not going to commence. It's not going. But look what happened. Look what happened. They're getting a point. They're getting like fifth. Top five finishes in the night on TNT, and I'm not patting myself on the back to say like I'm the reason or anything like that, but like there was a movement of fans and a movement of like these people who took wrestling so very seriously to sort of want it to be better.
Yeah, I mean, to me as a fan, when I was watching, when I first started watching New Japan Pro Wrestling, or when I was watching Independence, I never really cared that, like, oh, I want them to grow, I want them to be,
right,
I want other people to really like this. I just enjoyed watching it myself, and I was totally content on that end. Like, the success that AEW has had, you know, to me, is, like, beyond my wildest imagination. Like, we talk about, like, once a week or something, there's something, it's like, could you, if I told you 3 years ago that we were getting, like, you know, insert some random, you know, crazy match. Usually it's one that, like, Sting is in, because, like, it's like, you know, at Revolution, it's like, if I told you 3 years ago we were going to get, you know, Darby Allin and Sting versus, you know, Andrade and Matt Hardy is there, and like, it's like, what, all these guys would be wrestling one another, like, you know, and Jim Ross is calling it with Tony Schiavone and Excalibur from PWG, like, it just, all that kind of stuff, like, it just blows my mind. It would have blown my mind, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. I never really expected, like, this revolution in pro wrestling to take place.
So
you know, I think a lot of it is WWE created the opportunity for it by turning off longtime fans and not catering towards fan interests, which allowed a company that did cater towards those fan interests, specifically the fans who maybe disengaged from WWE for a variety of reasons, you know, kind of created this opportunity to swoop in. And obviously Tony Khan, you know, is a very unique person, given his life circumstances and his personal fandom, that makes him a very unique person to kind of put together AEW in a way that has been it in a way that's made it as successful as it has. I never anticipated, like, oh, this whole thing is going to happen in wrestling and it's going to change the world for wrestling. It was always just like, I was always just kind of happy to have the product, you know, for my own consumption.
Right. Right.
I didn't really need it to be any bigger.
Right. I never really expected it either, but when it did happen, I was like, I felt validated. I was like, boy, you told me I was wrong, you know, and here it is. That's how it felt.
Yeah, no, it's been great. Obviously, like, the mainstream stuff has made it more accessible for us, like things like New Japan World, you know, no longer having to order stuff on Ustream, you know, being able to watch, you know, the Young Bucks or Kenny Omega or any of these indie stars who became, you know, being able to watch them every week on national television is great. I mean, New Japan, like, I wouldn't have believed, you know, when I first started watching it, you know, 10 years ago or so, that I would have been able to have seen, you know, I've seen Tanahashi live, I've seen Okada live, I've seen Naito live, and, you know, I saw it all in Massachusetts. It wasn't like I had to go to Japan. So that kind of aspect of it's pretty incredible as a fan.
Yeah, it certainly is, and I've seen all those guys live too as a fan in Philadelphia. So it's just, I'm not saying like, it's just wrestling's about emotion, and like I would not be being honest to the listener if I didn't say I had emotional investment to it all as well, because this is the wrestling I grew up with. So this is the wrestling I indoors. I went to Shikara High Noon, one of the seminal independent high pay-per-views of all time. You know, and it sort of dawned on me when I was thinking back to that Shikara High Noon moment, and when Eddie Kingston pinned Mike Quackenbush, and Eddie Kingston cut that promo beforehand, and we see Eddie Kingston on television now, and people did not have to change to be this either, you know? And people did not have to lose their values or lose their judgment. They just, Eddie Kingston was Eddie Kingston the entire time and still got a chance at national television.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, it's such a great time. I mean, when I watch AEW, like, is the first. There's something about it, like, I don't know if I like AEW more than I've ever liked New Japan Pro Wrestling.
I agree too.
I like New Japan Pro Wrestling quite a bit, but there's something about the AEW being on a week-to-week, being, you know, week-to-week television, so many people watching it, being part of a community where so many people watch it, you know, having enough mainstream value that most wrestling fans are watching it, for the most part, or at least paying attention to it, that creates like this kind of shared cultural experience that I wasn't really getting with New Japan, because New Japan, even when it got really big, was still
a niche,
pretty small, yeah, and pretty niche within wrestling, general wrestling fandom. But when you have things like, just like these really like incredible moments, like the end to All Out last year, where Adam Cole debuts as kind of like the red herring for Bryan Danielson's debut, and you just have this incredible ending to the pay-per-view, and then just the pay-per-view ends, and everyone is just buzzing about it, and everywhere I look online, you know, obviously, like, the Voice of Wrestling Discord is talking about it, obviously, but even, like, you know, people who, other, like, a sports message board that I go on that's not, you know, a big wrestling thing, people are talking about it, like, just having this kind of general cultural experience with just the mass of wrestling fans is different than WWE, and then that is where, or is different than New Japan Pro Wrestling, and that is, to me, what kind of has made AEW uniquely special as a fan is taking all of a lot of things that I really like about pro wrestling and making it in a more mainstream, consumable form for people who maybe are not going to be as hardcore and diligent about finding stuff and being able to converse with so many different people about it is really fantastic. I love talking to casual fans or lapsed fans or fans who have sampled the AEW product and just see what they have to say about it, because it's such a fun thing to be able to see what people think about it who aren't like just, you know, super hardcore wrestling nerds like you or I and you know, the other people that we might engage with on social media.
It was so interesting when you had that guy on the podcast. It was so interesting, like, he exemplified, like, why it's good to do fan service. It's good to do that type of thing and give credit to your fans while also not insulting the intelligence of your fans. And I think AEW sort of toes that line very well.
Right, this, you know, so, yeah, so on my last episode of our podcast, the Gentleman Wrestling Podcast, I interviewed somebody who I knew kind of, I only really knew him a little bit, I didn't really know him that well, but I just knew he was kind of like a passing fan of wrestling, and he said he had purchased AEW Revolution, and it was the first pay-per-view he had purchased since, like, WrestleMania 7, so he had, you know, was a fan of wrestling as a kid and into young adulthood, but hadn't really been a consistent viewer. But for whatever reason, he was inspired to purchase AEW Revolution. And he talked a lot about what stood out to him as someone who was not a hardcore fan with AEW. And he talked about how, like, he even though he didn't know everything that was happening, he could see that people were excited and that these things meant a lot to those fans. And, you know, as even someone that didn't really have an emotional investment, you can appreciate when people are excited about something. And I think, you know, Brandon Thurston of WrestleNomics is really big on this concept of, like, having your fans be really excited on social media is a really viable and important marketing strategy to what you want your company, if you want your company to reach new fans, people who are watching, going on social media and, you know, going on their YouTube vlogs and whatever and saying, oh my God, this is so great, I'm so excited, that has a positive impact on people who maybe are on the fence about viewing or maybe have never heard of it before, but if people say it's really good, when a TV show comes out and I've never seen it, I never heard of it before, but if I log on to social media every day, and everyone's like, oh my God, I can't believe how good this show is. I couldn't believe the ending to the last episode. I'm definitely going to be more inclined to be like, oh, maybe I'll check that show out. It seems like people really like it. And some people are really dismissive about that, and some people seem to think that it's like, who cares if they make their dumb fans happy? It's all about attracting, you know, this mass casual block of fans, and your hardcore fans don't matter because they'll watch whatever. And it's like, I actually think it's really viable to say, like, it's important that people, casual fans, will be attracted to something that hardcore fans are really enthusiastic about, you know, even if they're not totally up to speed with everything that's going on with the product.
I think they'll get up to speed. I think that's the problem with the way WWE thinks. Is like, they get their fans up to speed, but it's in the dumbest of ways. And like with AEW, people get up to speed anyway. And it's phenomenal how I've seen fans who've never watched an ounce of Ring of Honor, never watched an ounce of Shikara, never watched an ounce of New Japan, still have a knowledge of this stuff, and still have a knowledge of these rivalries and stuff like that, and feeling very engaged with the product, yet in WWE, they give you none of that fan service.
They do, it's just in the service of nostalgia from 20 or 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And they have, like, this...
obsession.
Yeah, they, I mean, it's like you said about, like, WWE's very literal with how they want to get fans up to speed, which is kind of like hammer you over the head with a lot of stuff, and they don't just let stuff breathe. Like, I was talking about, like, the CM Punk entrance music, and my casual fan correspondent, he just said, like, oh, yeah, like, I don't even know that much about CM Punk. You know, but I could tell, like, it was his, they said it was, like, his Ring of Honor entrance, and the fans were singing along to it, so, like, I could tell it was kind of, like, the special, important entrance, and that was cool. Like, he's not there scratching his head, being, I can't believe, what is this? He's not coming out to his Cult of Personality entrance music, which the guy who was a casual fan who was watching probably wouldn't even recognize as CM Punk's distinctive music. He would have just assumed it was his regular entrance music. You know, and so it was. It's one of those things that I don't think. I don't know. There's a little like subtlety to it. WWE's bad at it, and AEW is a little bit more accepting. Where it's like, you know, people are going to be coming up to speed. Like there was a whole push, you know, right when AEW started, where everyone was like, "You got to have the, you know, the first episode of Dynamite and everything." Everyone was like, "You got to have little video packages. They introduce all the talents. You got to, you know, have all this information. You got to be throwing it at all these people because so many people watching for the first time. They're not going to know who the Young Bucks are. They're not going to know who Kenny Omega is. They're not going to know who Jungle Boy is. Like, who, you know, they're not going to know any of these things. How will they know? Like, how will they be so disengaged? Yeah, they won't keep watching."
Come
and
I was on. Like,
it's like if you watch, and it's like, if you watch a pilot of a TV show, right?
Like you don't just like throw or... these video packages out there, like
yeah.
They just introduce the character and then it's just go.
Yeah, one of the characters' personality is that they're kind of a dick, and one of them is like a dumb stoner, and one of them is like a really funny, like, gregarious person, and one of them is like always depressed, and it's like, yeah, like I understand the characters' personalities a bit. Like there's no video package introducing all of the various characters. You just accept that when you turn on a television program that you'll learn more about these personalities the more you watch. And, you know, wrestling is no different.
And we can turn this into the wrestling media discussion, which is like, I think a lot of this discussion is fueled by the wrestling media, which is like, I'm like, which AEW has melted the brains of a lot of people in the wrestling media. In like saying they're only an expert in WWE, like you said, and AEW sort of melted their brains a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, people just don't know how to react to a lot of things that AEW does. And so you'll see complaints about that exact same thing. It's like, we needed to introduce who all these characters are. It's like, because that's what WWE would do. Because when WWE introduces someone, they often spend like
4 weeks
hyping them up, and you know, here is coming or whatever, you know, they want to do. to kind of hype someone up, AEW is more likely to just kind of throw someone out there and put them in front of a live crowd. And so there's so many different things that AEW does that I think throws off people who have like a very WWE brain approach to what AEW should do. And it leads to a lot of, lousy criticism and lousy analysis. A lot of the people are not knowledgeable enough or open-minded enough about non-WWE concepts in pro wrestling to provide keen analysis on what AEW is doing. Because in some of it is like, a bad faith analysis because I'm a WWE fan first and I don't really care for this AEW product, so I'm going to make a bunch of arguments that don't really hold up when closely examined. A lot of it is just like kind of like, unmalicious ignorance. They just like don't know any better. And I think you see that with some people on social media and stuff. It's like, yeah, it's no wonder you think that because that's what WWE would do. But not everyone has to do what WWE would do in situations. You can do things like, we don't have to have a bunch of DQ finishes. We don't have to have vignettes that hype up every single thing all of the time.
There can be 50 people on the screen at once.
Yeah, we can have people on the screen. We can have people who are, maybe their babyface and heel role is a little bit more nuanced and you're not beating people over the head. We can have, here's a Japanese pro wrestler that you might not know, but we'll put them out there and the crowd might know who they are and they'll sink or swim and we're not going to, feel like we have to explain it to you people. All these things.
And we won't give them a racist gimmick.
Well, that's a different thing. I don't know if anyone's advocating for we need to give that person a racist gimmick on AEW, but I think it's just one of those things where it's like, I think because AEW, functions like a normal wrestling company, and WWE does not function, has so many, abnormalities when it comes to wrestling and how they choose to present their product, that a lot of people seem to believe that the abnormal way to present it is like the proper and good way to do it just because WWE has done that. And that's not the case. It's going to vary from person to person. It's going to vary from company to company of what is the best way to present your product. And I think there's really no way to look at AEW over the last few years and think that AEW's choice of presentation has not been a rousing success.
Yes, I agree. And also, you think about it and you just are floored with like WWE does some things very starkly different than AEW. That's very apparent. But there's many ways to do wrestling, okay? And like people get galaxy brained over like because WWE's the biggest company, the biggest suitor on the hill, that it's the only way to do it.
Which is very impractical when you think about like any other industry that it has one company that might be dominating the industry and another company that's kind of rising up. The company that's rising up is not always going to be like, okay, what is the dominant market leader doing? We need to copy every single thing that they're doing if we want to become the market leader. What they're actually thinking is saying, what can we do different that makes our product or our company more appealing than the market?
Right.
If you were selling, if you're selling fast food or something like that, you wouldn't be like, all right, what does McDonald's do? We have to do every single thing that McDonald's does so we can become just as successful as McDonald's. No, that's ridiculous. You would say, what does McDonald's not do? What are some shortcomings that McDonald's has? What does McDonald's, not provide that we can provide? Or can we do it in a different way that's maybe more efficient, that maybe people will like it more, and that will allow us to grow because people will be like, hold up, what's this new company? They're doing something different. Maybe I'll try that. And for some reason in wrestling, people like default to this belief that like whatever WWE is doing is the way it has to be for a company to be successful. That just doesn't make any sense if you actually think about it.
And actually, when the rising company gets success, it's actually the market leader is going to take from the rising company. That's what happens in business.
Absolutely.
And we haven't seen... It's funny because we haven't seen barely anything that WWE's taken from AEW. Except for Cody Rhodes.
I guess there's some resistance to that. Well, first of all, if you believe what Dave Meltzer reports, and I have no reason to think this isn't true, and there's a lot of evidence within WWE's own product that it is true, is that like the people high up in WWE think AEW's product is terrible. They think that they do a terrible job. They think it's just awful, terrible shit, and that they would never copy it because they think it's bad. And if we look at the differences between the two companies philosophically about what they do, it wouldn't surprise me that WWE thinks AEW is really bad, just like how I'm pretty sure a lot of people in AEW think a lot of what WWE does is really bad. And that's why the companies are very different, because they have two totally different outlooks on what they view as a successful wrestling product. So they're unlikely to adopt anything from AEW, I think, just based on that principle alone, which is like, if they're doing it, it must be wrong. And that kind of, you know, methodology trickles down from WWE administrative all the way down to, you know, members of the fan base who just assume if AEW's doing something, it's wrong, and I'm going to argue in bad faith against it, as opposed to having a more open mind. It's really what a lot of, you know, debate in wrestling comes down to, is the broad dividing line between people who only watch WWE and think that WWE is like the only really thing that matters or is important, and people who are willing to watch other products. It doesn't always have to be people who just watch AEW, but it could be other products as well. And I feel like that's where you get a lot of the philosophical differences between fans, is people who have been open-minded enough to expose themselves to non-WWE wrestling and people who have just kind of remained in the WWE bubble throughout their entire fandom.
Yeah, and like people who have, it's just like, it's almost like a cult-like thing, almost. It's like they pledge their allegiance and they just defend. And it's weird and it's sort of creepy in a way.
Yeah.
In sort of odd ways. And I'm not criticizing like WWE only fans. One of my brother's like a WWE only fan, and he's not creepy about it or weird about it. He just views WWE as his wrestling, which is fine. But I see it as like, I see like fans who have the avatars and stuff like that, and I see like, why are you defending this company with every ire you're being?
Yeah, I mean, I try not to allow, like, your crazy, Twitter stan fans to kind of color my opinion on wrestling WWE fans in general.
Right.
I think a lot of WWE fans are pretty passive in their fandom. I think there definitely are, you know, a segment of fans who are going to make bad faith arguments against AEW and kind of, to make this big divide between the two fan bases. I try to put things in perspective and say, this is a very, very, very small segment of ardent wrestling fans, many of whom are making up things for attention and don't feel that way from their personal opinion.
Right.
Really don't really feel that way in their personal opinion. But there definitely is kind of like a general indoctrination to WWE. I know, Dave Meltzer, he was kind of talking about WWE fans. I forget who they were referring to. It might have been Cody. This is like from a week or two ago. But it was just talking about how like WWE fans, the fan base that they have left, are their most ardent hardcore supporters, and they are going to support the brand of WWE over anything else. And if like, say, a wrestler leaves and comes back, they might be met with some questions and some resistance from the fan base. And I don't think this is the case with Cody, but you'll be seen as, okay, you left, so we don't like you. I think it might have been the example he might have used was with Ali, where it's like Ali isn't getting over with the fans. And you kind of think, would look at Ali's social media kind of campaign to get himself released, and you would think maybe in a prior era of WWE, maybe a few years ago, that Ali would be really over because he's kind of like this anti-authority figure and people will like him. But to the current fan base that they have, the 4,500 people that they have going to these shows, Ali's a guy who wants to quit WWE and we shouldn't like him because he's leaving us. And it's taken much more personally, and they identify much more with WWE, kind of the same way that people identify with their sports teams now. I always thought that was actually a good analogy for what WWE has become. like, as WWE is now, someone's a sports fan, they're, you know, in New York City, maybe they're a Yankee fan, a Giants fan, a Knicks fan, and a WWE fan. And WWE might be good, WWE might be bad, but they're never going to stop being a fan.
And it's sort of weird in a way, how WWE's almost transcended that into becoming sports-like in that ardent of a way, even though they are not sports-like in any other way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fandom certainly has. I mean, you talk about this is what happens when you have 20 years of unchallenged success, and that you're able to position yourself with a level of familiarity with your fans who have no alternative option really to watch, or there's not an alternative option strong enough to sway a lot of their attention away from WWE. You just become, if you like wrestling, you watch WWE. And unless you're curious enough to flip on, you know, TNA when it was more relevant, or to start watching New Japan Pro Wrestling, you're just going to be WWE for life, and WWE is wrestling to you. And the idea that wrestling outside of WWE is relevant and that you should be paying attention to it is going to be, it's going to be tough.
Yeah. Yeah. That's sort of poignant in a way. You know,
I mean, I really like soccer, and I really like, you know, I watch a lot of the Premier League, and I watch some MLS and some of the other leagues in Europe. But then, you know, there are a lot of people who will be like, I hate soccer. Soccer's stupid. It's not like, it's not American. Like, I'm just never going to watch it. And I'm going to be like kind of proud of my ignorance of soccer. And like, obviously I don't expect everyone to get into it, but I'm like, a lot of these arguments are dumb. Like, soccer is boring. Soccer is stupid. It's not American. All the guys are gay, or whatever you people, bad faith argument people want to make about it. And that sometimes I feel like that kind of ideology is similar when people talk about wrestling and outside of WWE, which is like, you know, I'm not going to watch these other non-WWE promotions. They're just these small things trying to be like WWE. And I'm going to watch what's like proper, which is, you know, World Wrestling Entertainment and Vince McMahon and that kind of element.
I think what got me out of thinking that way was sort of like, because I was sort of thinking that way in 2010, 2011, was like starting to independent shows, starting downloading tournaments of independent shows and seeing, oh, there's this other thing, and then seeing Japanese wrestling, and then seeing other things, and I was like, okay, there's a world outside of WWE that we should all be paying attention to, but it's never going to become like this big thing like WWE is. WWE is this touring brand that...
Yeah, well...
Sorry.
No, go ahead. Finish your point.
I was like saying, WWE is like this touring brand that sort of supersedes like Cirque du Soleil, almost.
Yeah, like it's not going to... Your indie company might see a show once a month, but it's not going to become, grow into like something relevant enough.
Yeah.
Like AEW has become. Yeah, like with like, so like we were talking about like doing things differently and how that can attract new fans and things like that. I know I first started watching TNA, and you know, TNA to me was always like, to me it was like, oh, it's like WWE, you know, because it's wrestling and it's weekly and it's on cable television and it has some, you know, Kurt Angle was there and Christian Cage was there and kind of like, you know, familiar WWE wrestlers were there. But what really got me attracted to TNA was the X Division.
Right.
And just these guys who were going out and doing cool moves. I liked the Cruiserweight division when I started watching SmackDown, because, you know, as I said, SmackDown had the Cruiserweights when I first started watching it. And I liked seeing, you know, this style of wrestling that was really exciting and really athletic and captivating to me as a young viewer. So I started watching, when I watched TNA, like, I could kind of care less about the, you know, the Kurt Angle and, you know, the Jeff Jarrett and all those guys. But I wanted to see, you know, AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels and the Motor City Machine Guns and those guys. That was what was like, oh, that was, you know, so unlike anything I was seeing in WWE, and I wanted to see more of it. The first independent wrestling match I can recall ever watching was I had seen Amazing Red in TNA. And, you know, he just did a bunch of cool shit. And I was like, I have to see more of this guy. So I went on YouTube to see if there were Amazing Red videos. And I was looking for videos in TNA. And ended up seeing a six-man, basically like a six-man scramble match.
Right.
From Pro Wrestling Syndicate in Long Island, New York. And it was like Amazing Red, Pinky Sanchez, a wrestler named Javier, Rich Swan, Anthony Nice, and one more guy. I can't remember that sixth person. I actually remember who it was too. He did some shots in TNA. I just can't remember his name at the moment. I think he went by Black G's on the Independence. But
Sabian.
Yes. Yeah. So it was those guys, and they just had like what would probably be like kind of just like a typical scramble match now if you watch it, but those guys, particularly Amazing Red and Tony Nese and Rich Swan, all, you know, especially Swan and Nese, were really young in their career. Like Swan was probably 18 years old. They just did a bunch of incredible stuff. You know, Rich Swan did a top rope hurricanrana where he jumped up from the ground and did the hurricanrana like he did. Just did like a vertical leap, and Tony Nese did like a, you know, the space flying tiger drop. Like they were just doing crazy stuff, and I was like, this is wrestling. Even though this is like low production in a bingo hall, this is stylistically wrestling I have never seen before as a fan, and I was intoxicated by it. Like I was like, oh man, this is the craziest wrestling I've ever seen in my life, and I need to watch more of it. And it was specifically, if I had been seeing that stuff in WWE, it wouldn't have batted an eye. But because the company was doing something different, it totally changed my perception of pro wrestling.
And I think also because you and I both come from watching sports backgrounds, and like we're both sports fans, like the athletic stuff gets us. And like watching matches where like athletic means really it gravitates towards us, and that's what gravitated me towards wrestling was the athletic stuff.
Yeah, especially as a kid. Like yes. As I've gotten older, I've definitely become more appreciative of you know, storytelling and other types of wrestling, like like Tomohiro Ishii, right? Who's not wrestling in athletic style, but there's a certain, you know, the physicality of it in that kind of drama. Like I've become more sophisticated, but especially as a kid, I was always really attracted to the high flyers and these you know, guys who were doing really cool stuff and just being innovative. And I don't know if it's like I don't know if it's like part of it that was just like, you know, being a fan of real sports and getting into like being able to appreciate the athleticism of the guys. You know, I always liked it, like my parents, especially my dad, you know, who were not wrestling fans. You know, if they were watching something or I was watching something and they were in the room and they would see like someone do a shooting star press, they'd be like, whoa, you know, these guys are really athletic. And, you know, that would make me feel good because it'd be like, yeah, like this is great. I always insist that if you wanted to show like a wrestling match to somebody who has never watched pro wrestling before, I would always pick something like the Will Ospreay Ricochet match at the Best of the Super Juniors, where it's just guys doing crazy shit. And it's like, yeah, like I could show them, you know, Ric Flair versus Ricky Steamboat, or, you know, Hulk Hogan versus The Rock, or, you know, some of these matches that people will point to as like, oh, this is what would get a casual fan into wrestling. It's like, they're not going to understand like the personalities involved at all. They're just going to want to see cool shit. And that's definitely what attracted me to a lot of new types of wrestling, was just guys doing cool shit.
Yep. I totally agree. And I'm attracted to storytelling now, and the tips and trades of storytelling and wrestling and stuff like that. And I've helped out at wrestling schools and stuff like that, and been behind the scenes at wrestling. And it's just, it takes a lot to go into that goes into wrestling that people don't even know. And it's an art. And people don't treat it like an art. That's what I've come to learn.
I think there's a balance. I think sometimes I think people get too, like, obviously I think like people like, you know, Bray Wyatt and stuff get too artistic with their endeavor, and they have to kind of forget that they're doing pro wrestling. And one of the big, like, kind of like annoying things that I think a lot of people say that I think is just patently untrue is like a match. Like, there's this big gap between a match that has a great story and a match that has great in-ring work. Like, you can only have one or the other. It's like, I don't really care about in-ring work. I care about stories. And it's like, well, every great match, with maybe a very few exceptions here or there, is going to have both. Yeah. You can't have a great match that doesn't have good in-ring work, and you can't have a great match that doesn't have a story. You know, we can point to exceptions here and there, but generally, you know, you have to, for a match to be great, it has to be like, you could have an amazing story, but if the guys are botching all these moves and, you know, missing stuff by a mile and not selling, or, you know, all these things that would make lead to a bad in-ring work, like, the match probably isn't going to be great. It just seems to me like people kind of get, you know, either one or the other is kind of this thing. That honestly stems back to, like I said, the divide between people who watch WWE only and people who watch more stuff, because people will say, oh, you know, this Japanese promotion might have good in-ring work, but there are no stories in it, which, you know, we know is really untrue, but it's become a way to, some people feel safe dismissing it by saying, like, yeah, that ring work might be good, or these guys might be athletic or anything like that, but there's no story.
Yeah.
Because they feel like you can't have great in-ring work and a great story for some bizarre reason.
And most matches have both. Plugs. I really enjoyed talking to you today, man. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, no. Thanks for having me on.
You have any plugs to share?
Yeah, I mean, I just tell people to follow me on Twitter, at Jesse Collins, JesseCollins. I mean, you can voiceofwrestling.com I write for WrestlingInc.com as well. I have a podcast, the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, that people can look up on YouTube. But I always just say, if you're interested in my work, follow me on Twitter. Because I'll be sharing, you know, all my articles that come out, all my podcasts that I'm on the drop. We had a podcast that just dropped yesterday. Me and my co-host Jason Umpresser, we just kind of previewed some of the major events happening for wrestling this summer. It's really going to be an exciting time for wrestling. We've got so many big shows and stuff coming up. Summer used to suck for wrestling. It used to be like, you know, SummerSlam and that's it. And SummerSlam,
it was a lull. It was a lull.
Yeah, and now it's like we got, you know, Best of Super Juniors, which starts tomorrow. From, you know, we're recording this the day before a Super Junior starts. I'm really excited about that. We've got, you know, Double or Nothing in a few weeks. We've got Forbidden Door coming in June. You know, if you're a WWE fan, you got some major WWE shows. You know, Money in the Bank is going to be a huge show. You got SummerSlam has been moved up. You got the big show in Cardiff coming. Like, so WWE's going to have a lot of big shows. And we got the G1 back in the summertime, too, which, you know, we hadn't had in a few years. It's been in the fall. So it's going to be, just no matter what wrestling you're into, this is like an awesome, awesome time from, like, just how much stuff's going to be happening.
This is an awesome time for all around wrestling fans, for WWE fans, for AEW fans, for New Japan fans. This is a great time for everybody, and we love wrestling here. And thank you to the Social Suplex Podcast Network, and thank you all for listening and your time.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.